Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the 25th GNSO EPVP team meeting taking place on the 13th of November 2018 at 1400 UTC. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the telephone bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now? Hearing no one, we have listed apologies from Caboose Aristov Gack, James Bladel of RRSG, Emily Taylor of RRSG, Aidan Federline of NCSG, Farzaneh Body of NCSG, and Alex Deacon of IPC. They have formally assigned Raul Goslin, Lindsay Hamilton-Reed, Volker Freeman, and Brian King as their alternates for this call and any remaining days of absence. During this period, the members will have read-only rights and no access to conference calls. Their alternates will have posting rights and access to conference calls under the members' return date. As a reminder, the alternate assignment form must be formalized by the way of the Google assignment doc. The link is available in the agenda pod to the right and the meeting invite email. Statements of interest must be kept up to date. If anyone has any updates to share, please raise your hand or speak up now. Seeing or hearing no one, if you need assistance updating your statements of interest, please email the GNSO Secretariat. All documentation and information can be found on the EPVP Wiki space. There is an audio cast and view-only Adobe Connect room for non-members to follow the call, so please remember to state your name before speaking. Recordings will be circulated on the mailing list and posted on the public Wiki space shortly after the end of the call. Thank you. I'll now turn it back over to our chair, Kurt Pritz. Please begin.
Thanks, Terry. Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here for non-part. I think you've had a chance to go through the agenda. I want to make one amendment to it, and that is with regard to Thomas Rickert's email yesterday. And Thomas isn't on the call yet, but I hope he's on soon. So he led a what I call a small group call with some members of that included some members of ICANN staff, notably John Jeffrey, to discuss the issue of the relationships in processing data, and in particular, his paper supported by many of us that was contributed to by Diane that proposed that ICANN and contracted parties were really joint processors of data and that they should enter into JPAs, joint processing agreements. So you've read Thomas's email on that, and I think we should reserve some time in this call for Thomas to report on that. And Thomas has to leave after 90 minutes of the call, as we all like to. So I propose we go through this agenda for about an hour. I'd like to get to the welcome and update section and also the data redaction section, and then propose turning it over to Thomas for a report on his meeting at the top of the hour, either at the end of those two sections or if we're not through them then yet, turn it over to him at the top of the hour. So that's the updated agenda. To go through the updates at the top of the meeting, The support staff sent many documents. One is an updated draft of the initial report so that in an effort to keep you continually updated with changes that are made. So it's sort of a balancing whether to save all the changes and plop them all over the fence at once or keep you updated with drafts from time to time. And so this draft covers the changes that have been made in our discussions in the previous few meetings since the initial report draft was first published. And then also there's been many comments made on the Google Doc, and the vast majority of those have been captured for discussion, but some were clearly corrections or administrative changes or something to make the document congruous so with itself. So some of those changes have been made and incorporated into the draft. So please look at that. You might particularly look at new language on the Ebro and how that's folded under data escrow and the new language there, and also we've included a proposal in the from the business constituency with regard to dispute resolution processes and how and their request to perhaps receive information on registrants prior to the filing of a UDRP. So that position is captured in the document. So if you would look at that updated draft of the initial report, that would be great. With regard to the natural versus legal persons and geographic status, you also have what we hope is the final version of what's going to go into the initial report. The, you know, I'll just say the originally proposed five-line interjections, now a book. But for the purpose of the initial report, I think it's important that we capture all the comments that were made. I think that's done, and I want to close that off and say we're going to publish that in the initial report. So you'll want to review that, but if there's no recommendations made, that's fine. I just want to indicate one issue that's been raised by the GAC that had a recommendation for a comment that the GAC made a comment. Lorraine Lipman made a comment to a previous version of that document that we think her comment or the GAC's comment is captured in the IP, the intellectual property business constituency comment. So the GAC could, you guys in the GAC could either read that and say, yeah, we agree with that, or make an edit to it, and that'd be fine. And then we've also made reference, I believe, to Amr's intervention on the email list. That's a different issue. That's about data redaction, but I saw Amr's name come up, so I got confused. So that's the status with regard to legal versus natural persons and the geographic basis for differentiating registrants. Amr?
Hi, Kurt. Thanks. This is Amr. Hello, everyone. I actually wanted to, I'm just as keen to wrap these two issues up as soon as we can, but I would like to offer propose another change to the natural versus legal issue that I hope will be considered a friendly amendment of sorts. And that's just to, whenever reference is made to differentiation between natural and legal persons, that this be replaced with differentiating between personal information of natural versus legal. I believe this would more accurately capture what's in the GDPR and what we've heard from the EDPB, because that's actually, I think that's where the nuance of the issue is as far as GDPR is concerned. There is a part of a letter from the EDPB in the report currently, and they do make that clarification. They don't clarify it, but they frame it in that sense. And if you look at Recital 14 of the GDPR, they also refer to it as personal information of legal persons, natural persons, or personal data. So it's not actually a distinction between the person, whether it's legal or natural. It's the distinction between the personal data concerning the legal person or the personal data concerning the natural person. So I hope this is acceptable and not too controversial. I don't think it's that big a deal, but I think it would be more accurate. Thanks.
Thanks, Amr. That was really clear. Alan?
I don't think we can unilaterally make that distinction. Yes, we have to be concerned about personal information that might be included in a legal person's entry, but the GDPR is very clear that it's talking about differentiation of legal persons versus natural persons. And I think we have to maintain that consideration, and I believe it's also part of our charter. Thank you.
And Alan, so what's your concern there about this is for my understanding, so I hope I'm channeling some of the group. So what's your concern there about if that – changes made, what might be lost or what issue might be left on the cutting room floor?
We've had the discussion a number of times, and there have been people who have voiced the position that if a legal person includes personal data in their entry, that is their responsibility, and it is presumed that they have gotten appropriate authorization. That's been said by people from NCSG. It's been said by people from contracted parties. So I think we need to understand whose responsibility is it, and can the registrar judge whether something is personal or not? Now, you know, I can come up with an email that sounds like a generic one, and it's someone's name. People have all sorts of unusual names. So I agree with the position that made that it may be difficult, but the distinction we're talking about is whether that we are dealing with a registrant who is a legal person or a natural person. And I don't see how we can unilaterally change that. Thank you.
So Amr's in the chat. Quoted recital 14. So go ahead, Milton.
Yes, I think that was kind of the point I was going to make. That this distinction that Amr is trying to introduce is simply based on a direct, clear reading of the GDPR, and it's the data, not the entity, that a GDPR addresses. So I don't see why this is controversial. I agree with Alan that we don't want to get into a game where we argue for our sake. It's just a more accurate statement of what the GDPR says, so let's get on with it.
Margie?
I have, like, time to think about it. I just want to read other parts of GDPR. Also, to remember that the policy is not limited to GDPR. We're trying to make one that's broader than that. So I just think if we could just table it for the next Thursday's discussion, at least we'll have some time to think about it.
Yeah, it'd be great, I think, if Amr could bolster his, you know, his statement and his text in here with some writing, I think. Because certainly we're trying to protect data here. Hadia, fingers crossed. Go ahead, Hadia.
I just wanted to make a quick note with regard to distinction between natural and legal persons. I would like to say that the issue is not as ambiguous as some of us try to make it look or seem. So the European Commission, on February 21st, 2018, the European Commission answered a written request by an EU Parliament member, Richard Tulloch, who asked a question in this regard. And I would like to read to you the EU Commission reply, which is, of course, you can find it online. It's where an email address uses direct identifiers of an individual, and he gives us an example, johnsmith@gmail.com. It is personal data falling within the GDPR. It goes on saying the recital 14, and then it gives some examples about what is considered legal and what is not considered, and what is considered personal, a natural person. So it says, however, personal data of employees of the legal person, including their professional email addresses, would fall within the scope of the regulation, and it gives an example, johnsmith@ikea.sk. The processing by a company of a by a company of an email address such as flower234@gmail, this falls under the GDPR, but it gives other examples, for example, that do not fall under the GDPR. So it says an email address of a legal person such as ikeacontact@ikea.com would not fall within the scope of the regulation. So actually, we have a response from the European, a written response from the European Commission in this regard. And in order to always be tackling this issue as a gray area or an area that we don't know how to tackle, actually we have clear responses in this regard. The argument or the debate would be how to implement this or how to make sure it's implemented in this manner. So that's just a quick note. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Hadia, and thanks for the work you've done to make your audio clear, makes your points a lot better. So I think I like Margie's suggestion and Amr's gracious acceptance of that, and so I think he's making a point here that's you know, it's definitely valid in some ways, so determining whether it rises to the level of making a change to the initial report is what we have to decide. So Amr's writing on this will be anticipated, and thanks very much for bringing it up. So with regard to, I'm marching down the agenda here, so with regard to review of outstanding action items, I got to stop reading the chat. I've got good news and I've got bad news. So the good news is, you know, we don't really have any outstanding action items except for, you know, all the work required to produce the initial report, and that includes the matrix of issues that you were sent yesterday that we are likely to begin discussion on today, plus the outstanding issues that were left that were indicated, so quite a bit. And the result of that will no doubt require the laying in of additional meetings that could occur as early as tomorrow, but I want to take the temperature of the group. So look at your calendars, and at the end of this call, maybe I'll let Marika give some options as to when we can get together outside this, and then we'll firm that up with some sort of poll or something like that to see when people are available. But that's the news there. So I don't have any other action items, and so I will let's go on to the next section of the report, which is data redaction. And this is what's being put up here is the proposed language in the initial report in really small font. So if I don't know if you can put in the link to the doc, or you guys can download it from email so you can read it more easily. And I think the issues here for you to look at are relatively few, but we have left unsettled whether you know, whether organization is personally identifiable, contains personally identifiable information or not. It seemed to me anyway that the majority of our team thought that this information could be published. There's an intervention by Amr that's referred to here and captured here that in support of redacting that data. There's also the remaining issue of city or province in combination, whether that's personally identifiable information. And then finally, there's email. And in the list of the data, we tried to make that really clear, and so want to get sign up to that, but we have two emails. One is the email provided by the registered name holder, which we identify as personally identifiable information and will be redacted, and then the anonymized email address for contacting the registered name holder that will not be redacted. So we captured that under two line items. So I hope that you've had a chance to look at this, and rather than tick off any one of the open issues, I'd appreciate comments first having to do with this document and making it part of the initial report, and then second, if we have time, on the issues overall. Ashley, please go ahead.
Thanks. I don't know if this is the appropriate time, but I had a couple of small edits to make to this document, if possible. The first of which being, if you scroll to kind of like the just past the middle part of the page, starting with the EPDP in italics, if you go to the second bullet, there's in track changes a sentence that's been added to the end that says there was some disagreement as to whether the following elements should be redacted for they contain personally identifiable information. If there's any way we could add in here as they could contain personally identifiable information, because it's not a given that organization provides PII. Thanks.
Thanks, Ashley. I'm sure that can be accommodated. Are there any comments to Ashley's edit or any other comments on this document? Go ahead, Milton.
Yes, I think her rewording is correct, as they could involve personally identifiable information. I think the point is also that with the organization name, even if the name itself is not personally identifiable, it could be used to identify a party, and that's what some of us are concerned about.
Right. Alan?
Thank you. I'm not sure why postal code is there. It was mentioned, but it was pointed out that postal code in many jurisdictions might be as little as in one house. In my, where I live, it's one side of one block, and I don't think there's anyone at the end who was suggesting that postal code be published. So I think it's a red herring to include it there.
Thanks, Alan. That's what I recall the agreement of the group was, that there's there's areas where a single house has its own postal code. Any other comments? Ashley, do you want to come back to Alan, or?
No, I agree. Assuming what Alan was talking about is that I think we all agree that postal code has problems in terms of being able to identify a person. The only other thing, and again, I'm sorry for making what probably sounds like nitpick edits, but we had some conversation within the GAC on another thing. I'd like to note, and I'm just trying to identify it in the document. Bear with me 2 seconds. There's a reference to there is no consistency in terms of how the organization field is being used. And I'm trying to find it in the document. Essentially, all we wanted to change was from no consistency to that there is a lack of consistency because while this might sound kind of pedantic, it's to note that actually it's in that last bullet on page under that EPDP, the same header that I was talking about, and the last major bullet in the first instance, in the context of the organization field, the EPDP team noted that there is currently a lack of. I'm sorry, it's already been changed. My bad. I'll shut up. Thank you.
So we've been here on Skype waiting for you to get to that.
Sometimes it takes longer than other days.
Are there any other comments about this? I want to say that you know, we're closed on this. I think it raises the right issues with the right amount of specificity for public comment, and so we can take the public comment and feel comfortable getting to, you know, finality on these few remaining issues on redaction. You guys can talk instead of type. Thanks, Milton. Go ahead.
Just want to make sure we have that highlighted area, add others as appropriate. I saw Thomas say that you could add the ISPs, and I'm not sure if anybody else was in there as well on the organization field.
You want to be in on that, Thomas? Go ahead, Mark.
I think we need to be clear about distinctions of personal data versus personally identifiable information, because I think personal data is the controlling term, you know, the legal thing, and PII is not. So it's okay for us to have concerns about things that are personally identifiable information, but we need to make a distinction as to the legal impact of one versus the other.
And so are you saying in every case we should remove references to personally identifiable information and replace that with personal data, or are you correcting my
I think the actual term, so I got scolded by my lawyers on this, is personal data of an identifiable person. I think that's what it was. So yeah, there is some sort of a distinction, and we should, you know, if the comment is about some people are worried about this being personally identifiable, I mean, that is a reasonable thing to put in because people are interested about, you know, worried about things being personally identifiable. But in other cases, if we're being specific, I mean, if we're talking about the legality of something, we have to use the correct language, which I believe, and the lawyers can fix me, is personal data.
Go ahead, Benedict. Thank you, Mark.
PII is an American term. Personal data is the European term. And with this, there's discussion on the chat about further redacting of the org field, and I think we should be just cautious to not confuse ourselves between stuff that's collecting of personal data and a field where there's bad data quality. So personal data may have crept in, but there's no intent to collect personal data there. So I wouldn't support redaction for that reason.
Yep, I think that's clear. Alan?
Thanks very much. Just very quickly, on Benedict's point there, if intent was that which guided us in this, our jobs would be a lot much easier. The fact of the matter is that until we fix the system to not allow that to occur, where there may be some sort of a possibility that we're not strong enough in the system to prevent that from occurring, well, then we must look at that at an appropriate level of risk. So intent is probably not the word that we should be throwing in here, because the intention is probably not within our control, I'm afraid.
So not within our control, but I think the question we have is, so I agree with that, Alan, but I think the question we have is, you know, does that give rise to liability? And that's one of the questions that we seek answers to. Benedict?
I'm not really into this idea of just considering risk on the side of the contracted parties. I think that there is a systemic risk that arises from not having this data published, and that I don't think that side has been articulated clearly enough here, because it's in no one's specific interest to make sure that the systemic risk to the system of not having this data available is captured. Thanks very much. Secondly, I'm kind of surprised at NCSG, and I was going to write a long rant email about this, but actually, I felt that NCSG would be sort of aligned with the idea of not helping enshrine corporate personhood, the idea that companies shouldn't get treated like normal people. And I'm really surprised that I haven't been hearing that from you guys. So maybe you could, one of you could talk to that, why we're treating, we're sort of falling into a de facto treating companies the same as people for this legal natural persons debate. Thanks.
Yes, Milton.
Hello, Benedict. This is Milton. So is this a reference to the Supreme Court decision in the U.S. about free speech and legal personhood? I'm not sure how seriously to take that. But anyway, the reason is not that we are equating organizations with people. It's just that in many instances there are, in effect, small public interest groups or entities that are in some sense organizations, but in another sense they're so closely associated with an individual that that to publish the organizational information or the organizational name would effectively identify them. I know that the for many years the who is entry for internetgovernance.org of our Internet Governance Project had my own home address and name in it, for example. So that's what we're concerned about. Hope that explains it. Bye-bye.
Margie?
Hi, it's Margie. I wanted to agree with Benedict. I think that it's important to include the other perspective in this language regarding the systemic risk to this system by not having this data available. And I'd also suggest in the bullet point that talks about where the EPDP team discussed the data elements, and then it says there was some disagreement as to whether the following elements should be redacted. The whole thing reads as though there's no support on this team for having that be available. And I think that, you know, while we heard the NCSG, I think there's broader support among others in this EPDP for having that data published. And so I just want to make sure that the language is nuanced so that it reflects that view as well. Because it reads like the EPDP thinks that it shouldn't be publicly accessible and that it should be redacted. And that, I don't think that's what all of us believe.
So, Margie, could you add one sentence that indicates the groups that are, if it's not there, that indicates the groups who support the publication of this guild? And Benedict, could you write one sentence that states your concern about systemic issues, and a second sentence that sort of that describes that? And we can add those. And Hadia, Alan, and Stephanie, if you have something else, let's go through the queue. So, Hadia.
Okay, I have just a quick comment in response to Milton. I want to remind us all that the GDPR ensures the balance of the rights of individuals against other rights, including public interest. So we should trust that those who make the law got the balance correct. And For us, what we need to do actually is make sure we comply with GDPR. If we do this, we are sure that we got the balance correct. We don't need to worry that rights of certain individuals might not be met. Thank you.
Thanks, Hadia. You know, to me, at this stage of our inquiry, we're trying to determine whether the these data fields contain personal data or not, and if they do, they should be redacted, and if they don't, they should not be redacted. And then we go on to the next thing, which is under what conditions are those disclosed that require a legal basis, and that's where I think that sort of balancing takes place. Alan, go ahead, please.
Thank you. The problem is it might contain personal data, and that's where the balancing comes in. And I think Benedict is right. We cannot simply reduce one party's risk and not consider the other risks associated with redaction. However, I put my hand up on another issue. Milton's example is exactly the kind of discussion that we're having here, which completely detracts and takes away from the real issues. He pointed out that the Internet Governance Project registration had his home address. We're not talking about the address field here. We're talking about the organization field. What was in the address field is completely irrelevant and will be redacted, depending on how we go ahead and treat it. But simply saying that we should redact the organization field because there's an address which might be considered personal is simply mixing apples and oranges. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan, and I think that this is why we've got this language in here that points up this balancing that's taking place on this one data field, and we'll see if we get any information in the public comment that sways anyone. I personally doubt we will, but we'll have to get to a conclusion at some point, but probably not today. Stephanie?
Stephanie Perrin, for the record, I hope you can hear me. I just wanted to add to Milton's excellent explanation about the NCSG position. It seems to keep getting left off, but I'm going to keep bringing it up again. One of the issues with small organizations is that they have charter rights that are protected under the European Charter of Rights. I haven't got the title correct there, but the one on which this data protection regulation is based, so entirely relevant, and that is that identifying the organization may put individuals at risk. Alan is correct. If we're redacting the address and the postal code and the names of the relevant officers, then obviously we're doing the correct thing. But I don't want anybody to lose sight of the fact that protected organizations such as religious institutions, political speakers, et cetera, transgender groups, for instance, are put at risk by publishing their data. So thanks.
Thanks very much. Alan Woods?
Thank you. As I stare into the edge of a particular rabbit hole in this, I'll just say one more thing, and it's just a gentle reminder that, you know, the scope of what we're trying to do here, and the scope is the temporary specification as written enough to allow the contracted parties to maintain compliance with the GDPR? At the moment, we're saying that as the system, as it currently is there a chance that there could be a breach by the inadvertent completion of the organization field? And without having to go and change and rehaul the entire system, we're saying that there is a high risk, in fact, of a breach. So I don't understand where the systemic issue is. The systemic issue here, as far as I'm concerned, is, you know, continuous breaches of the GDPR. And also, it's not just about the risk. Again, I do not claim to be the white knight in this. But again, we're thinking about the data rights of the individual as well. If somebody's personal data is breached due to our inadvertence, well, then that is still a breach. And yes, it does affect the risk of contracted parties as well. We are on the same page on that one. So I just want to point out again, just bringing it right back to scope, what are we trying to achieve here? And as far as I'm concerned, there is support there for the current reduction of the organization field. And again, a recommendation if we want to say the system needs to be changed so that we can make this not an issue in the future.
Thank you, Alan. Go ahead, Mark.
Similar to Alan's just last comment, when we get to recommendation number 3, this is one of those areas where the anonymization of this field is meaningful for natural people and less meaningful for legal people. And so this is another place where we would want to include that comment that system.
Right. And I hope that the comment that Benedict's writing about systemic issues also includes, you know, another sentence about what the, you know, what the effects, the benefits or costs of that are, so we can do that balancing later on. Brian, go ahead.
Yes, please.
Yeah, thanks. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Great. So I would just note that recommendation 3, speaking of which, is not the IPC's recommendation. We've been pretty clear that the web was not sufficient for a number of purposes, and so I don't think it's fair to represent this as the preliminary recommendation of the EPDP team, because we think the web form is not sufficient, and it's better in cases where if we can make that legal versus natural person's distinction, but it's important to note that we think that the email address is important.
For what reasons?
For what reasons? What? Do we think that the web form is not sufficient?
Yeah, or yes, or the email is important.
Okay, well, I think we've been pretty clear about that, but we're not able to identify trends in registrations across multiple registrars, right? If a registrar is anonymizing the email address differently than the other registrar that the bad guy is using, you can't do that with even an anonymized email address. Web form does not allow for the presumption or the at least argument that the contact was made with the registrant. If you're trying to prove notice in some court case, you don't have the same presumption of delivery of postal mail or evidence that an email was sent with no bounce back received. There's a lot of reasons why it's not good enough.
All right, thanks, Brian. So we're gonna have this discussion again. I asked for some, to the extent it's amenable to everyone, I asked for Margie and Benedict to make those contributions. I think we've captured Amr's intervention sufficiently from earlier. So, I think we've preserved that in the arguments in a way that can be put in the initial report, that if there's any new information that will help our deliberations, it will come from that. So I think that's done there. I might, you know, we might also ask ICANN why that their rationale, why the org. Organization field is not redacted in the temporary specification. So I'd ask the support team to capture that question and what the thinking was, to see if they've gone through the same process as us, or it was more cursory or just different. So I'm going to close this off. Thanks very much for your comments. We'll capture those, look forward to a couple more contributions, and then button this up. So, Marika, do you have something you want to add?
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. I don't know if we were already wrapping up the conversation on this whole item or just the redaction part, because there's still an aspect of both the questions in relation to this issue as well as the preliminary recommendation that you can find on I think, page two. That we haven't really discussed yet with this is what is the group willing or planning to put forward in relation to email contact. There are two specific questions, I think, in the charter questions that relate to that. The first one is, should standardized requirements on registrant contact mechanisms be developed, and under what circumstances should third parties be permitted to contact a registrant, and how should contact be facilitated in those circumstances? That currently has been translated into a preliminary recommendation that basically has bracketed language for what is being recommended. On the one hand, I guess an obvious option is to follow current requirements of temporary specification, but then, of course, other options are variations thereof or something completely different. So it would be helpful to have some guidance here, what the group's thinking is specifically with regards to what should be going into the initial report on that topic. Art, are you still there?
Yeah, so I'm just thinking and waiting to see if anybody raised their hand, but I don't see that. So, and I'm reading the email list. So is there a position that an email address is not personal data? Is that the position that's being put forward? I'm just reading Mark's comment here. Go ahead, Milton.
What I heard was not an argument that the email address is not personal information. What I heard was that they wanted to use it to do searches, generalized searches of the WHOIS database that would allow them to detect patterns in registration.
Okay, Alan. Thanks, Milton, for the clarification.
Thank you. The EDP, I never get this right, European Data Protection Board has made it clear that we should counsel registrants who are legal persons to not put personal information in email addresses and advise them that there are ways of making sure they do not have personal information. That's one of the few clear rulings we got from them, and I think we should pay attention to it. Thank you. Seem to have lost Kurt.
No, I'm here. I'm just thinking about where to take this conversation next. Stephanie?
Sorry for the delay there. Stephanie Perrin for the record. I would just like to put that counsel from the European Data Protection Board in some kind of context. There's a very long history of them telling ICAM that they were not paying enough attention to registrant rights, including giving them any kind of advice about where the heck their data was going and how it was being managed. So you have to take that in context. ICAM gives almost no information to the registrants about how to manage their domain name registration, how not to put their personal information into their website name, how not to provide data because it's going to be scraped up by data brokers from the WHOIS. So I really think that to say that that is a concrete piece of advice, they're counseling ICANN to fulfill their responsibilities. That doesn't mean that you can rely totally on educating the public and transfer the responsibility onto them. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Stephanie. I'm going to take the comments of the group and move on. And you know, so we have so what we have is I'm a little bit low to let it go. So we have recommendation 3 that includes essentially the language of the temp spec, but also bracketed language or a lack of language from the IPNBC that that needs some discussion. So we can move on and leave this for the initial report or an email discussion, I think. That was sort of incoherent by me. I'm just reading it. All right, so we'll just note Brian's comment in this section, and then we'll move on. Gosh.
Kurt, this is Marika. If I can then ask one question. So does that mean that, you know, those that have not spoken up on this issue are comfortable for the purpose of the initial report to recommend that current requirements remain in place? Noting that I think the VC and IPC have indicated that they do not support that, and we can note that in the report, or is that a reasonable assumption of the silence, or is there something else that staff should be doing in relation to recommendation 3? I'm just trying to get some direction here.
Okay, let's follow the we're going to make a notation with Brian's comment and then include that, and let's move on. So Thomas, yesterday I said in the introduction to this meeting, Thomas gracefully led a discussion that included John Jeffrey and about the processing of data and the parties involved and who were controllers and who were potentially joint controllers. And it was kicked off with the memo written by Thomas and contributed to by Diane and the comments of others. And so I'd like Thomas to take over here, which will be a relief for you, and, you know, review the topic of the meeting and the issues that emanated from that. So, Thomas, please go ahead.
Thanks very much, Kurt, and hi, everyone. And Amr is spot on in the chat. Before we discuss this, let us as an EPDP team put our birthday wishes on the record for Dan, who was excused for yesterday's call because he was celebrating his birthday. So all the best to you, Dan. In fact, yesterday we had the small team meeting on roles and responsibilities, and we had hoped to more or less come to consensus in the small team on the recommendation to make to the EPDP plenary to basically nail down the concept based on which we're going to frame our initial report. And I think that based on the discussion that we had so far, there was an emerging consensus that based on the parameters that we've already discussed in this group, the majority of stakeholders represented on this EPDP team views the GTLD world as a world of joint controllers. So we tried to basically summarize what the roles offered by the GDPR are so that we're fully aligned on what a processor is, what a controller is, what a joint controller is, or what co-controllers are and why this is no co-controller scenario, and then basically look at the rationale for joint controllership to finalize the language that I have suggested with the support from Diane. Then John Jeffrey, who thankfully joined our call, chimed in and said that a legal memo is in the making, a 10-page memo that is currently being prepared, in which ICANN org summarizes its concerns and its feedback on the draft language that we are currently discussing for inclusion in our initial report. And while we don't know about too many specifics, I guess, and I do hope that the other participants of yesterday's call will do sanity checks on what I'm saying so that I'm actually reflecting the content of this meeting accurately. JJ more or less said that there are concerns inside ICANN.org, that we are putting the cart before the horse by concluding that we do have a joint controller scenario, that we should first look at all the individual processing activities and then determine what the responsibilities of the various parties are, to then subsequently make a decision on whether a joint controller situation or another situation is present. There was also some discussion on how our group, if at all, can make such legal determination and whether that could be binding, because you always find lawyers that see things differently. So we had a discussion on this. We had a little bit of back and forth on our team, and unfortunately, my AC connection is patchy, so I can't see whether any hands are raised. So let me disconnect and dial back in, and then while I'm doing that, Kurt will need to help me manage the queue. But the, I guess the main point is that we try to convey to JJ that whether or not a joint controller situation is present is not too much at the discretion of the parties involved. In other words, it's not for the for the parties to a potential joint controller agreement to look at what their liability risk is and then cherry-pick a legal solution that suits them best. But if you look at the rationale for Article 26 in the GDPR in the first place, to help data subjects to have an easier way to approach responsible parties in complex worlds of data processing so that the data subjects are not forced to identify which party is responsible for what processing activity and whom to approach to exercise his or her rights. If you look at the rationale that the data protection authorities want to have an easy time approaching the right person for questions of compliance, if you look at the micro versus macro level of data processing scenarios, i.e., what would the user see? You know, the user provides data to a provider, untechnically spoken, and hopes that subsequently a domain name will be registered and resolved in the DNS. You know, they can't understand what the parties involved are. And therefore, the most likely applicable scenario would be one of joint controllership. Having said that, even in a joint controller scenario, you can and you should lay down who is responsible for what, who is taking care of what actions, who is responding to user requests for rectification or erasure of data, who is responsible for informing data subjects about what data is collected and the like. And then you can back that up with indemnifications as you see fit. So I think that all our explanations did not really help convince JJ that a joint controller scenario is the path to pursue, but there are concerns. And I guess that the questions that we will now need to answer are what I've summarized in my brief summary to the group, namely, if ICANN.org, and Kurt has chimed in on that point, that it's difficult for a policy-making body such as ours to do legal assessment. if the authority of the EPDP team and the EPDP mechanism to speak to legal questions is questioned, then I think we need to answer for ourselves, do we want to respond to that charter question? And if we can't respond to that chartering question, then we need to go back to the GMFO Council and flag that. So I think that the first question that we need to ask ourselves and find an answer to is, are we willing to take that job? And if so, I think we need to plow forward and make a determination to the best of our abilities and put that that answer out to the community for comment. The second question that we need to answer is, how are we going to deal with this question time-wise? Because we were not given a delivery date when the legal memo is going to be shared with our group. And I, for one, am really concerned that if we put out an initial report where the stakeholder groups and constituencies could not digest the concerns, the potentially valid concerns that ICANN and ORC has, it is premature for them to form a view because they might have a different opinion on the legal scenario if they put ICANN's thinking into the equation. So that's the second question. We need to ask ourselves, are we willing to submit a report in the absence of having read, having digested, having discussed inside our stakeholder groups and constituencies and inside the EPDP group what the impact of ICANN's view on this is? And I will also add, and then I'd really like to get a discussion going, I'd like to add that it is most unfortunate, in my view, that we have board liaisons, that we have ICANN staff representatives on our team, but yet we had to find out in the 11th hour that ICANN has been proceeding to draft or have draft a legal memo that questions the outcome of our work. You will remember that Chris Despain said when we asked him in LA, will ICANN sign such document, will ICANN actually do that, he said, I have no reason to doubt that. And so there was complete silence from staffers as well as from the board liaisons when we asked what legal advice has ICANN sought, is there any intelligence that we can build our work on? There was nothing, and then only we found out yesterday. And I guess that's something that we really need to flag as we move on, because it's really embarrassing for this EPDP group. It questions the legitimacy of our processes if we are being bypassed and if such information that's important to our decision-making is withheld from us. So I think I should stop here and hand it back over to Kurt to manage our discussion.
Thanks very much, Thomas. So I just want to make clear from my naive standpoint that or maybe ignorant standpoint and maybe to start the discussion. So we as a group could not determine as a matter of policy that there should be agreements that are similar to joint controllership agreements signed between ICANN and the contracted parties. Is that incorrect? So this is purely a matter of law where some independent body will make that determination, and if so, you know, how does that work?
So I guess, Kurt, I guess it's perfectly okay for our group to look at the GDPR, look at legal literature, and come to it, to its own conclusion on what this is. So I think it's not too brave for our group to come up with a solution and say, well, looking at all this from a 10,000 feet perspective, this really looks like a joint controller situation. Put that out to the community for comment. And probably the European Data Protection Board will also comment on that. And they can tell us if we're far off. But I think what will not work is look at the responsibilities and then try to find a situation that's best for the parties involved, because that's not the idea behind the GDPR. The idea behind Article 26 is to make it as convenient as possible for agreed data subjects and the authorities.
Go ahead, Diane.
I'm in supporting Thomas's sentiments of how he described yesterday's conversation and how Stephanie and Milton also see it. This is a factual analysis that we're making in line with our work. And so for us to be able to answer the charter questions appropriately, we have to be making these determinations. So it's a factual analysis and it's a legal analysis. And we also need to get to, I think, the point in point number one, which Thomas, the difference between a legal assessment and policy work is that it is a fine line. And if you look at our charter questions, the charter questions ask us to apply or to analyze application of the GDPR. So even though we could say that rightfully our group can't give legal advice, we are intuitively providing legal analysis on how to apply the GDPR. And so I don't think that we should step aside and let JJ or anyone else be able to explain that, in fact, it's not our position to be able to provide these factual and legal conclusions in relation to what we're doing. I think it's a necessary part of it, and that we have to push forward to making I can't give us the answers and not all of a sudden put forward a legal memo that's going to curtail the conclusions that we need to make. I also just want to point out that JJ is very concerned about the distinction of not wanting to assign joint controllership here, saying that, in fact, it's a liability concern of ICANN having to take on too great of a risk. And that ultimately, Thomas and I had discussed the possibility of putting forth a legal memo to be able to support, or even a memo in general, to be able to support our position on how ICANN has to answer addressing the joint controllership role right now, because I think you also need to put forth the fact that joint controllership agreements is something that is different from a DPA in that the controller is not beholden to a third party in the same way as a processor is, and that they're limited to only act on the instructions of the third party, so that the joint controller agreement sets out different roles, but it doesn't need to cover the same Article 28 requirements by the GDPR for processing agreements, so that the joint controller agreement provides a lot more flexibility in being able to proportionately assign liability, which in fact protects both the contracted party house and ICANN. So this is to a benefit of everyone to be able to assign these roles and to put forward the application of joint controllership.
Is that so? Thank you very much, Diane. That was very well put. And maybe for the rest of the group, you know, is that factual and legal analysis for us to do, or for us to commission, or maybe split for us to do the factual analysis and someone else to do the legal analysis? Benedict?
Hi. Thank you very much, Diane. What I heard Chris say in Los Angeles is that unless we came up with a completely crazy recommendation, the board would sort of make that happen. So whilst I think I hear Thomas's recommendation, I think, and perhaps I'm misunderstanding, but I don't see why this would fundamentally affect the nature of our work. If we say we have proceeded on the assumption that there will be a joint controller agreement, because that seems to logically flow. However, we're not lawyers. As Kurt just mentioned, we do the sort of data flow analysis, and we make a recommendation that the legal analysis be done by a qualified lawyer, which we are not for the purposes of this group. Or am I oversimplifying?
I think Benedict, that Thomas yesterday went to a higher level than I did in the discussion and recognized that even if the board were to, you know, adopt what we say, if it contradicted a position of ICANN staff, that's still not good for the big ICANN. And so it's better for us to understand what their position is fully and take that into account the best we can. That's not to say at the end of the day we can disagree with it, but it's better for all of us if we take that into account. So that's, anyway, Thomas is next in the queue, so he'll put it better than I.
Thanks very much, Kurt. A couple of points that I'd like to make. First of all, I guess that our group, or I see a lot of comments in this discussion, and I think we need to try to take stock of this interim result. I think there's no one who says we should not make a determination on this, right? So if there's anyone on this team who thinks it's out of scope or beyond our authority to speak to this chartering question of responsibility, they should now make themselves heard. In the absence of such objection, I think we should take note that we think that it's within scope for our group to make a determination on the question of responsibilities. The other question is, how can we advance our decision making on a joint controllership versus potentially other governing models? And whilst I've heard a lot of support for a joint controllership, Hadia, for example, said that she has concerns. And maybe we need to hammer that out a little more. What are the options for us? I think that given how interwoven the work of registries, registrars, and ICANN is, it's more or less absurd to think that they are just co-controllers throwing data over the fence and everyone does with them what they think is appropriate. So there is an organizational structure behind that. What can that be? Can it be a controller processor situation? And I think that would be going too far, because typically you have controller processor situations where a party doesn't want to do processing itself. So it's a typical outsourcing scenario. But if you look at ICANN registries and registrars, neither of the parties can do the other party's jobs, because in this ecosystem, everyone has their distinct roles. So I think they are not acting purely on the based on orders of another party, right? So I think data controller processor relationships are out of the question. That leaves us with the option of joint controllership. And I think it's important to remember that in joint controller situations, not all controllers need to have the same job. In fact, not all controllers need to have access to the data. There are innuendos in various places. The Article 29 group has written that there is potentially a joint controller situation. The Hamilton memo has specified that there might be a joint controller situation. So we're not taking this out of the blue. Then you find something in Article 26 itself, in legal commentary. If you look at the Facebook fan page, European Court of Justice decision, or in the Jehovah's Witnesses decision, you find clues on, you know, if there is an organizational structure that's been followed where everyone has their roles, that's an innuendo for joint controllership. So I could offer numerous hints why this should be joint controllership. So I think that those who question the joint controllership should ask their questions in writing, and then I think we as a group need to discuss this. But I guess that whatever scenario we come up with, we need to put in a recommendation and then wrap it up for our report. Lastly, very quick point, why is it important, in my view at least, to not publish a report absent having seen ICANN feedback? I understand what Chris said. I understand what others have said, that we should, you know, not be afraid of making our recommendations, that ICANN org's view should not stand in the way of our policy work. I guess that's what JJ said verbatim on our call yesterday. Yet, I'm afraid that we see history repeating. In the CCWG accountability, we had consensus and a report out on an organizational corporate structure for the post-transition ICANN environment. And ICANN.org then put the global public interest card and said, we're not going to buy this, we're going to put this to a halt, right? And that happened twice in the CCWG accountability, which I happened to co-chair. And I'm just very cautious that it will be an embarrassment for the community, for ICANN, on world stage, if we come up with a recommendation to which ICANN then responds, that's all fine, but we're not going to sit at the table and negotiate a joint control agreement, right? And I think ICANN might have good reasons for alternative suggestions, but I don't want to prejudge that what they say might not be valid, but I think it would be very dangerous for us to put something out not knowing what ICANN's concerns are and properly discuss that. And then we can make an informed decision. Either we can find a way to be aligned with ICANN.org and move forward, which would be great, because ultimately the contracted parties and ICANN need to sit at the table and hammer this out. Or if there are issues, we need to find a way to get across those issues. So I think I should pause here. I guess that would be my attempt to offer a way forward in a constructive fashion, and I hope that you take it as such and not as trying to disrupt our way towards publishing an initial report, which I think needs to be delayed a little bit.
So let me capture Thomas's thoughts a little bit, and hopefully your comment targeted at these. So the first point Thomas made was that you know, is this our job to answer this charter question? Is this our undertaking? And he wants to hear from anybody who says it is not. So we're going to assume that it is our job unless somebody says it is not. And then second, your comment might go to Diane's assertion that we should undertake this first factual review and then legal review. And maybe we don't know which bits of that we might outsource, but do we want to take that on? The third is should we wait for the ICANN memo on this topic before I don't think we should stop work on this, but before reaching any conclusions. And I think the answer to that is yes, but I think we should get some answer from ICANN when that would be ready. So that's the third thing. What's our strategy with respect to the ICANN memo, and then finally, you know, what do we do about the initial report, and how do we handle that if this waiting for this memo would in fact delay the initial report? What do we do there? And so I have some ideas there, but those are the types of comments I'd like to see from the group. Go ahead, Alan.
Thank you very much. I tend to agree with the analysis of joint controller, and I'm not privy to ICANN's internal thinking, and it may well have to do with their attempt to try to assume all of the liabilities instead of the sharing them with the contracted parties. But I'm not at all convinced that our decisions on what items to redact, what to publish, what to anonymize, and all of the things related to what the temporary spec currently says and we're supposed to be analyzing, I'm not sure how that's going to be impacted by the decision. So although it would be nice if we agreed, if we don't agree, I'm not sure that our substantive decisions on how to replace the temporary spec are going to be impacted. In other words, which items will we redact or not redact because we have a different controller relationship. And therefore, I think the substantive work we're doing has to proceed. We have a charter question to answer. We have to answer it. And I'm not at all worried about embarrassment of if the controller issue changes, unless we believe it will substantively affect how we make the other decisions. I just don't see that we need to delay the report because of it. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Alan. Nope.
Yes, this is Milton, NCSG. I'm happy to agree with Alan that there's no reason to delay the report. I think we're approaching this fear of an ICANN intervention with an attitude that was maybe appropriate 3 years ago, but is no longer appropriate. The accountability mechanisms have been redefined. We make the policy. We have to, as part of our charter, answer the question in some way regarding who is the controller and who is the processor, et cetera. Whether ICANN likes that or not is worth hearing what their views are. They've had every opportunity over the past 6 months to tell us what those views are. They haven't made very good use of them. I think we have to completely shut out of our minds the idea that ICANN's opinion about whether it wants to be a joint controller or not is somehow determinative or limiting or constraining on what we can decide or what the law dictates. That's just an absurd notion. If under the law and under the structure of the GDPR, ICANN is deemed a controller or a joint controller, that's a matter of legal fact. It's not something that ICANN's, like in the old days when ICANN decided it didn't want, for example, a membership model during the accountability process, well, they were still in a position where they could say, we're just not going to accept this. This is not the case now. It is simply and factually not the case. Whether they are a controller or not is a matter of law. And we have been, asked to sort of premise our discussions on that. So I think Alan is right. If there's some way that this determination affects what we redact or how we modify the temp spec, then it can have some bearing on our results. But the idea that ICANN's legal department or staff or organization may not accept what we do because they don't like the liability, that's just out of the picture. That should be given no credibility whatsoever. So please, let's not delay the interim report. I mean, what would be the purpose of that? I don't understand what that would accomplish. We should go ahead with the report. The report will give us all, including ICANN, a discussion, an ability to discuss and answer the questions it poses, and then we'll be moving forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Milton. Please go ahead, Amar.
Thanks, Kurt. This is Amar. Kurt, I think you mentioned two key issues that we need to consider in our decision of whether to postpone publication of the initial report or not. One being, what would a delay mean to us and the entire process in terms of meeting our already delayed deadlines? And the second would be, when are we actually going to get a copy of the memo so we can start factoring in what ICANN Legal has to say to us? But in principle, I agree with both Alan and Milton. I don't think it would be a good idea to delay the initial report. I'm not sure what constructive purpose that would serve at this point. I think we will have more time, perhaps not as much as we need, but we will have more time during the public comment periods to review the memo, and we could treat it as that, as another public comment, but that's, of course, under the assumption that we get it as soon as possible. Also, we do have that 3-day face-to-face in January. We could possibly do a lot of work on that if we still need to at that point. So I think it would be a good idea for us to proceed as planned and just wait for that memo to come in and address it when we have the opportunity to do so. Thanks.
Thanks, Homer. Benedict?
Hey, guys. Another data point on this one. I'm kind of concerned that JJ's risk aversion or ICANN Legal's risk aversion is causing them to kind of stick their heads in the sand and shout la 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 la, thinking that that will stop the GDPR monster from eating them. This is, as we know on this group, this is not a good way to proceed here. I've asked him. I actually met with him at the beginning of October, and asked him to clarify how ICANN Org handled
registration data internally, or was proposing to handle registration data internally, and that's for things like compliance, like we've already talked about, but also this sort of internal research that Okto and the security folks do. Emailed him on the 4th of October, still haven't had a response. So I think I'm tending towards the idea that we shouldn't hold our breath for a legal memo, and if we are prepared to give ICANN.org and ICANN Legal the chance to do that, I would suggest that we bound it very tightly with the deadline. So if they want to, I think we invite them to help inform these discussions with any legal thinking that they've had, but by no means let, you know, and give an offer maybe seven-day deadline to provide that data, otherwise it won't be included in our sort of determinations. Thanks.
Yes, and 7 days is even far away. Thanks very much. I want to interrupt the queue because I think Thomas needs to go soon. And so my question, Thomas, is absent this issue that with ICANN, how would you proceed creating a section for the initial report on this topic? And just to get to the reason I'm asking is probably obvious, but I think we probably want to stare at that and then make judgments about whether and how to include it, how to caveat it, et cetera. So I hope you think that's a reasonable question, Thomas.
I do, Kurt, and I feel guilty for bypassing the queue, but I think that probably a way forward would be to give EPDP members 24 hours to ask questions with respect to the joint controller setup, you know, the concerns they might have, the questions they might have, and I will try to respond to those together with Diane if she's willing to help me with this as well, so that hopefully we can get aligned on Thursday's call and nail down the language of our report. And then keep it probably at a quite high-level, broad brush recommendation that you know, number one, we think a joint scenario is applicable. And number two, that recommend that ICANN and the contracted parties negotiate such agreement. So I guess that that could be a way forward and help us conclude the drafting of the initial report. And I should probably clarify, because this all got quite a negative spin. I think that my primary driver for waiting for ICANN's input prior to the publication of the report is because I'm curious what they have to say, because I think that what they might have to say is valid and might impact the drafting of our report. So thanks. I hope this is an agreeable way forward.
And when we're doing that, when we're making comments, Thomas, we should look at the paper that you did that to which Diane added comments?
Correct, Kurt.
All right. Thanks very much. So Thomas has a couple minutes left, and I think we want to wrap this up while he's still on. So if we could go through the queue in short order, Stephanie.
Thank you, Stephanie Perrin. I'm going to respectfully disagree with my colleagues. I think we should delay the initial report until we at least have framed questions around this very, very fundamental problem. The question of who is the controller and who is in a co-controller relationship and who is merely a processor influences purposes. And you have to read into the 18 years of the DPA's asking who, what the purposes were, that has to fall out of that, because these are not new concepts. So the fact that we are about to emit a preliminary report where this is up in the air troubles me greatly. I'm afraid that we will get input back that then has to be analyzed in the context of a new forthcoming framework. It makes a big difference who the controller is, not to take apart, take away any unique controllership arrangement that the businesses and the contracted parties might have. Thank you. So I would suggest that we get a move on, get that memo, and then release the report. I don't think a week is going to make a difference. But framing of those questions is very important for our analysis. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephanie. Diane?
Kurt, I just have a question with regard to process. I'm not familiar to know. Is there a way for us to be able to delay, as Stephanie said, with an official letter to ICANN Oregon Legal saying that we are waiting for this memo and that as specified within the charter questions that we have made a full factual analysis in line with our work and to be able to properly complete our work and publish the initial report for full and legitimate comments by the public, that we need the legal memo and the full input of, regarding rules from ICANN. Is that something that's doable? I mean, what is the timing restrictions that we're under?
I think the answer to that, well, Thomas could answer it better, but just to get through this a little bit quicker, is to look at the report as it's written now and see if we feel comfortable where it stands, or if we want to add language, like you said, Diane, that we need additional, the team, this is our initial assessment, the team's undertaking that additional effort. Alan?
Thank you. If we got a legal memo that said ICANN is the sole controller, and we believed that it will be acceptable to the Data Protection Board, that would substantially change our work, because that would change the liability issue on contracted parties on which a fair number of our decisions have been made. But even if we get the legal memo tomorrow, we are not going to have certification that it's going to be acceptable to the data commissioners. And without that, I don't think we can change our work. And if we get that a month from now, then yes, we're going to have to do a lot of work over again, and so be it. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Amr?
Thanks, Kurt. This is Amr. I just wanted to add 2 points that John Jeffrey mentioned yesterday with which I agree. He said that, you know, that our reports should not be delayed in any way because of hard legal. That we'll be short of those and that we're postponing publication of our reports because of those legal questions, then we're never going to publish anything. The other thing he brought up was that, you know, ICANN can provide input to the EPP team at times, but it should not in any way become a barrier to the EPP team reaching consensus on its recommendations or publishing its reports. So I agree with both those points, and I think we should proceed as scheduled. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Amr. Margie?
Yes, this is Margie. I guess my question is, do we have to publish right now the controller analysis? I mean, we have so much work in the report as it is. We'll certainly get benefit from hearing public input on all the other things, and then just make a note that we're still working on the controller and role issues. I don't know. It's just a suggestion because I feel like there's a lot of good come out of publishing the report, but at the same time, I hear the concerns about maybe making a premature call if there's something that would change our analysis.
Thanks, Margie. I'm sort of with Stephanie that this is a key issue that should be addressed. And I think what we put in the report should be tempered with the sort of things you're discussing. So I think we need to have that issue clear and in front of people so we can get feedback on it. Where are we? Hadia.
I just want to refer us back to Appendix C of the original temp spec, where there is a table at the very beginning of the section that identifies the roles and responsibilities with regard to each of the processing activities. And looking back at this table, ICANN has identified itself as a controller for all of the processing activities. So with regard to the collection of the data, we have the registrar, the registry, and ICANN as a controller. With regard to the transfer of registration data, we have the registrar, a processor, the registry, a controller, and ICANN a controller. So it goes on. So, but the one thing in common between all activities, processing activities, whether it is collection, transfer, publication, disclosure, data retention, all the activities, the one common thing that ICANN is a controller. And then the differences come where the registries are the, and the registrars are controllers as well in relation to the activity or not. So I don't know if this would be helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much, Heidi. And I just want to note to everybody that Thomas is gone. So, but I think the input here is good and can be reported back. Benedict, maybe take us home on this one.
Hiya. I hear what Hardy says. Appendix C does say in every column, every line that ICANN is represented that it is a controller. What would be really interesting would be a statement on whether ICANN believes that means joint control or not. I think there's been some disagreements about that. It strikes me that whatever we get in this memo, I feel that we are now in a position of expertise. As I said already, I've spoken to several members within ICANN staff and JJ himself. I feel that whatever we receive is going to actually, in the memo, probably won't necessarily be that helpful and will probably cause more questions than it answers. I don't get the impression that it will be a straight statement of, yes, we acknowledge that we are a joint controller in this role. I think that's what we're all hoping for, but I would suggest that's not going to happen. So my list, after listening to all of you and the weighing up, because I think we're really talking in a good way here and really discussing this in a very productive way, my suggestion would be we proceed as Matter suggested on the chat, with a note that the memo exists and that we are awaiting it with interest, but do not change our publishing schedule. Thank you very much.
Kurt, you may be on mute.
I was, so I just wanted to build on Benedict's comment where he said that we're in a position of expertise in taking that as meaning, in fact, we are the ones that are suitable to do this work. And so that building off comment, I'd ask you to all read his report. I have some comments on it, too, if I'm allowed to make a comment, and he can take that to build what should go into the initial report on our behalf. And so we'll take that from there. So I'm going to Stephanie, I think that's a former hand, right? Do you have a comment for us?
Sorry, old hand.
Yeah, well, former hand, not old. So thanks very much. So I'm going to turn this over to staff for action items and then, some important discussion about how we're going to get this amount of work done in the time we have allotted. Marika, do you have a list of actions?
Yes, thank you, Kurt. This is Marika. So the action items we have from today's meeting is first of all, for staff to circulate a clean version of the draft initial report to the EPDP team. Second one is the EPDP team to consider whether the change of referring to personal information of natural versus legal person instead of natural versus legal would be appropriate, necessary, and provide feedback ahead of Thursday's meeting. Action item for the GAC team to clarify or confirm that edit in relation to the natural versus legal document. Scrolling down. We have an action item for Margie to provide language in relation to support for not redacting certain fields in relation to the data redaction section, and for Benedict to provide language to capture a risk of not publishing organization field info. An action item for staff to update language to reflect that the BC, IPC, and ALAC do not support a preliminary recommendation. And number three, I just note there, I think that Alan indicated that the ALAC may provide a further rationale in that regard. We have then the action items coming out of this conversation. EBDP team to ask any questions within 24 hours in relation to the documentation that Thomas provided. And then an action item for, I think, Thomas, and I guess he may be working with Diane on that, to provide proposed language for inclusion in the initial report in time for Thursday's meeting, factoring in the EPDP team's discussion today. And I also noted one question for ICANN.org in relation to data redaction, which is what is the rationale for not redacting organization field in the temporary specification? I think that's all I had on my list.
That's quite a bit. I also, a couple more comments that are important. One is, I understand I'm about to get information on possible locations or the location for our face-to-face meeting, but I don't have it yet. And as soon as it's beat into some sort of shape, I'll share within minutes. And so second, as the support team has pointed out to me, early and often, we need to somehow extend our discussion. So this is dismaying to me and more dismaying to you. The options I see, or the options that have been given to me, but I agree, is either to make these meetings longer with an intermission or meet on Wednesday and or Friday. So so if you could, gird your loins. And Marika, do you think in the next half hour or so you could put out a doodle poll and we could, you know, who's available tomorrow, who's available Friday, who's available for an extra hour on Thursday, and you know, depending on what the response to that is, we'll schedule meetings or not, and we'll tailor agendas as best we can to who can participate. And you know, I understand that there's a risk here without full plenary participation. So I just want you to know I'm very sensitive to that and will resist having a meeting if I think that the attendance would obviate the ability to sufficiently discuss issues. So I think that's the best way to go about that. Is that okay with you, Marika?
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. Yeah, we could definitely put a doodle poll together and release that as soon as possible. I would hope that indeed people, you know, do block out some time if they still have for a potential meeting tomorrow. Then I think the other option is indeed extending on Thursday, and you know, I think that the third option you gave is an additional meeting on Friday. I just wanted to note that the main objective of that additional call would be to go through the list of comments that was circulated with the agenda yesterday. So those are comments that were made where staff doesn't really feel in a position to either make those changes because either they you know, seem more substantive than mere small fixes, either we're not clear on what is actually being suggested or asked for, you know, there may be other ways in which the comment has already been addressed, and I think we've reflected that. So, you know, for those that may not be able to make additional time available, you know, please do look at that document, and otherwise, you know, respond on email or share with your groups or your colleagues what your positions are in relation to that, so that at least, you know, even if not everyone from all groups are available, and you're able to talk to those items, because I think those are, at least from the staff perspective, some of the main things we do want to get some direction on to be able to finalize the initial report.
Thanks, Marika. Are there any comments to anything? Thank Diana, and particularly, even though he's absent, I want to have it on the record to thank Thomas for again going effort to support us, and make us look good to the outside. So I'm glad I could put that on the record and thank us. And thanks, everybody, for a constructive call today. Thanks very much. Have a great day.
Thank you, everyone. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Operator, if you could please stop all recordings to everyone else. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.